Okay, so now let us come to the very end of the Noble Eightfold Path. We're going to finish off with Sammasati, right mindfulness, by finishing off the Anapanasati Sutta, and then quickly have a look at the very last factor. But before I do that, there was one question yesterday about the that simile of the city. Of the consciousness sitting in the middle and all that. And the question was, what was the connection between the simile and the rest of the sutta? And I had a very quick look at it, and I think the connection is just that the idea is just that the Buddha was giving a general description of the path. Yeah, everyone else was giving their version, and the Buddha gave a general description just using a simile. I think that was the point there. So he was kind of drawing all those various explanations together and then kind of making it into a coherent picture, so to speak. Okay, so back to Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And we had a quick look at some of the initial prerequisites for the practice of Anapanasati. And as often, some of these initial prerequisites are often the most important part, because as I mentioned before, you find in the suttas that meditation practice itself is in large part just a matter of letting go, of not using any willpower, just allowing things to be, and allowing things to kind of fall into place. And if that is the case, then of course, how you establish yourself, how you get started, all the preliminary work that you do, that is really where it is at. And that is how the kind of this automatic process gets started. So those things, that little paragraph there, but just having gone to the forest and establishing mindfulness, this is kind of really the critical aspect of mindfulness of breathing. And once you get that, the rest of the process just happens. So you just sit back, you just enjoy and chill and have a good time. That's really what the rest of the part things are about here. So then it says in the sutta, having established mindfulness in front of you, ever mindful, one breathes in. Ever mindful, you breathe out. So once mindfulness is established, then you just breathe. It says here, it says ever mindful. And I think sometimes it's interesting how little words like that can actually have a surprising, make a surprising difference. And the Pali word eva actually can mean different things depending on the context. It can mean like ever, which is like an intensifier, if you like. But it can also mean just or only. And I think that is actually the appropriate translation here. Just mindful, you breathe in. Just mindful, you breathe out. Not ever, because ever suggests that you're already very powerfully mindful. But that degree of mindfulness actually comes further down. It does not come at the straight at the beginning. I think just mindful is preferable. And of course, what does that mean, just mindful? And what it means, it refers back again to this idea that you don't really have to do very much. As long as mindfulness remains established and remains solid, there's nothing else that you have to do except sit back and just enjoy the process by itself. Just mindful you breathe in, just mindful you breathe out. Don't do anything, just kind of be that passive observer that we've been talking about before. So there, right there, you see kind of the idea of passive observer kind of comes into the suttas. All these ideas that we talk about when it comes to meditation, they can be almost always traced back to the suttas in one way or another. And if not, then we have the right to question whether the ideas actually are right or not. So ever mindful, you breathe in and you breathe out. And this is what happens as you do so. Breathing in long, he understands, or you understand, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, you understand, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you understand, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, you understand, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So that is called usually the first tetrad. Tetrad because there are four bits there, and there are four such tetrads in the Anapanasati Sutta. And each tetrad corresponds to one of the Satipatthanas. So this first tetrad corresponds to body contemplation, kaya nupassana. Yeah, that comes down further down in the Anapanasati Sutta. It's not been included here, but that's what it says specifically in the sutta. So if you want to fulfill body contemplation, this is all you have to do. Yeah, it specifically says that further down. You want to fulfill body contemplation, all you have to do is breathe, do the breath contemplation in this particular way. So that already kind of makes things quite nice and easy. And then you have breathing in long. Yeah. So the idea here is to understand that you are breathing in long. So it's a very simple understanding. Don't have to think too much about the middle, the end, and the beginning of the breath. Just the knowledge that you are breathing in long, or if you're breathing in any other way, just the awareness of the breath is really what it means. The reason it says breathing in long there is just kind of the, you know, you have to have something to know that you are actually aware. So that's why it uses that idea of long. And also the idea of long is that if you watch your breath in the right way, the breath tends to start out long. Yeah, you are already quite relaxed. So the breath is quite kind of easy and long. It's not kind of shallow and tight or anything like that. But as you become more peaceful, the breath actually often shortens down. So it starts off long and then it becomes shorter. And this is, I think, is the reason why it starts off with long and then short, because this is actually the natural process of the breath as you calm down, as you become peaceful. Yeah, so it doesn't mean anything apart from that. It doesn't have any. It doesn't mean you should try to breathe long. It doesn't mean you should try to breathe short. All it means, you should sit back and you should understand whether the breath is long or short. That's all. Yeah, just awareness of the breath. Whatever it is, it's fine. Don't try to control it. And then in the next factor here, it says that here it just says he understands. In the next one, it says he trains. Yeah, I shall breathe in experience in the whole body of the breath. So why does it say understand first and then train afterwards? I think the reason is, and it's difficult to know exactly why some of these things, but I think the point here is that once you have established mindfulness, yeah, which you are supposed to do before you even start this, that's a really important point. Once you do that, it is natural that you just sit back and you understand, or you know that you're breathing in long or short, yeah, because the mindfulness is already there, so this happens automatically. But to be able to experience the whole breath, that's now we're talking about the beginning, the middle, and the end, and any other point of the breath. To do that, it takes time. You have to actually have more than just mindfulness. You also have to start to get some tranquility. Training here does not mean that you use force or willpower. It doesn't mean that you exert yourself very much. It just means that it takes time for these things to happen, for these things to come into place. But as you sit back and as you watch, this happens automatically, and that is the training there. So you train experiencing the whole body of the breath, sabbakaya patisangvedi. Sabbakaya patisangvedi actually literally means experiencing the whole body. That's why of the breath is in parentheses there. So why? What is it? Is it, some people say it is the whole body, physically, literally. Other people say it means the breath. Which one is it? And here it is. This is a good question. How do you decide what it is? And there is very little to go by in the suttas to make a decision on these things. In this case, the commentaries are the ones that say here it refers to the breath rather than to the physical body. That's actually specifically stated in the commentaries. And I think in this case, it is natural and it is reasonable to take it to refer to the breath. Kaya, the word body in Pali, just like the word body in English, just means a conglomeration of various phenomena. So breath can be considered the body in the sense that it is a group of phenomena grouped together called a body of breath phenomena. So, and also this is about breath meditation. So because it is about breath meditation, it doesn't really make sense that suddenly you talk about experiencing the body. So this is, I think here, the right way to do this is to follow the commentary. This is also how Ajahn Brahm interprets this. It makes, I think, very good sense. But in certain traditions of meditation, they actually interpret this to mean the whole body. So whatever you do, it doesn't matter all that much. As long as you make progress and as long as you're calming down and becoming more peaceful, it doesn't actually matter all that much, whichever way you interpret this. But the whole body of the breath, I say, is the right one here. Then as you keep on training, just sit back, relax, enjoy what is going on, then you tranquilize the bodily formation. And the bodily formation, remember here, sankhara means like intentional activities. So here it means something like the bodily activity. And that bodily activity in this case is specifically called, is specifically defined elsewhere as the breath. So this actually does specifically refer to the breath. So breathing in, I tranquilize the breath. Breathing out, I tranquilize the breath. And already at this point, things start to become very nice. If this happens automatically, the breath is becoming peaceful, you have full awareness of the breath, already it starts to become very nice, easy, very kind of, your mindfulness is established and the process happens so easily. And you're just really relaxing with the whole thing. So even without any kind of happiness and joy, already it's a state of relaxation and ease at this particular point. But you can see here that it takes a little bit of knowledge of the suttas to actually interpret this. If you read that, tranquilizing the bodily formation, it is not obvious what it means. So sometimes you do need a bit of experience to be able to draw out the meaning of these things. So that is the body contemplation part, equivalent to body contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta. And of course, the next one in the Satipatthana Sutta is the contemplation of feelings, Vedana Nupassana. And that is what we come to in the next tetrad here. The next four stages are all about Vedana Nupassana. And this is how it goes. It trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. Rapture is piti in Pali. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure, the sukha in Pali. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. So this is the Vedanupassana, and you actually fulfill, you complete the contemplation of feeling, of Vedana, just by doing that. You don't have to do anything more than that. And what is so marvelous about that is that it is all about happiness. It starts off with happiness, with rapture, and then it goes to basically to deeper and deeper states of pleasurable feelings. Tranquilizing the mental formation is just that. It is kind of going into deeper and deeper states of pleasurable feelings. And isn't that a kind of a great message? No need to contemplate all the pains in the body and the pains of the world or whatever. All you have to do is do the positive feelings. And if you do that in the right way, you're actually completing the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings. And the reason why this is sufficient is because if these things happen, you have already abandoned the painful feelings. The painful feelings are gone, so you contemplate the painful feelings indirectly through their absence. You know that they are impermanent. You know that they are non-self. You don't need to contemplate that they are dukkha because that's too obvious that they are suffering, painful feelings. Are they suffering or not? Okay, yeah, they're suffering. It's pretty obvious, yeah? That's an easy one. So you... all you have to do, you contemplate the what is absent through their very absence because they have ceased. So all you have to stay with is the happy feelings. It's such a beautiful message that the whole Vedana Nupassana can be done through experiencing joy. And this is one of the messages of the Anapanasati Sutta. Anyway, so let's have a look at this. So experiencing rapture, piti. Piti is the joy in the mind. Often, kind of, you can often feel it physically in the whole body. You can feel it in different ways, like a tingling feelings, or like, you know, things going like a rush going through the body, and all these kind of things. Some people feel it more mentally. So there are various ways of feeling rapture. But this is when meditation starts to become very nice, yeah, really enjoyable. It's already very peaceful, and now this joy starts to arise. So that leads to perhaps the little bit of a question: how do we go from just tranquilizing the body in the previous step to actually experiencing happiness? For some meditators, they find they actually experience so much tranquility on the path, but they have sometimes it doesn't move on to the pleasure of the joy and these things. So how do we go from one to the other one? And this is sometimes where you need to nudge the mind a little bit, just to kind of bring up some positive perception, and remember some of the perceptions that the Buddha emphasizes for us to use at this particular point is like things like simple things like the silanusati or chaganusati. So if you find it's hard to move from the tranquility to the joy, sometimes you have to recall something very positive in your life, something that makes you happy, makes you feel good about yourself. Yeah, very, very briefly, the joy. Then you go back to the breath. Then hopefully the two together will actually then give rise to joy and breath together. Or, as some people have pointed out, you can do a bit of metta practice together with the breath. If you have a lot of confidence and faith in the Buddhist teachings, you can even just recall the qualities of the Buddha and the Dhamma that we were talking about before. Yeah, and this can sometimes be sufficient as well. But the Buddha places a lot of emphasis, surprisingly a lot, on these contemplations that give rise to joy. Yeah, the idea is to think about things in such a way, have the right attitude, that joy comes along with it. Sometimes, and then that helps you to make the transition, into these feelings and into the Vedanupassana. But you have to be very careful, because if you are very tranquil already, you don't want to think very much, you don't want to contemplate a lot. All you want to do is like nudge your mind a little bit towards these kind of perceptions. It's almost like you're just giving rise to a perception inside of you of something wholesome in the past, something you feel good about. Yeah, it's a very simple little thing. It's not something that you can't do too much, because otherwise you just destroy your meditation at this particular point. So the rapture arises, and it feels really nice. Sometimes you wonder, you feel kind of content with where you are already, but actually you can take this much further. And then as you do this, as you contemplate the rapture often starts to become a bit, calm down a little bit. And as the rapture calms down, you get a deeper sense of contentment that is more peaceful, more tranquilized. And that is the sukha underneath. These two, sukha and piti, are very closely related to each other, sometimes very hard to pull them apart. But usually one is more coarse than the other one. That's usually how they are explained. Sukha comes after rapture. Then you come to this thing called the mental formation. You train breathing in, experiencing the mental formation. Mental formation in the Pali actually refers to the experience, the perception and vedana of your experience, the feeling tone and the perception that you have at this point. So here the main perception you have here is just those feelings. Yeah, it is just the piti and sukha itself. So it just refers really to those things. You're what you are aware of that time, and the main thing you are aware of is precisely piti and sukha. So recently I know that Ajahn Sujato translated this mental formation as emotion. That's his translation for this. And although emotion is very broad in this context, obviously emotion refers to this very narrow band of emotions, all the pleasure that you experience at this point, that is what it refers to. So you experience the emotional content of the mind, and then you tranquilize it. Yeah, that's the last step. You realize that this is still, not entirely still. So you tranquilize, allow everything to calm down even more. But remember, each step here is not something that you do. The purpose of this is to give you a roadmap. It shows you where the mind tends if you allow the mind to be completely. Yeah, if you just relax, if you just enjoy, this is where the mind tends to go by itself if the foundational things have been put into place. So training just means sitting back and allowing things to be here. And this is the roadmap. It starts to tranquilize, yeah? Becomes even more peaceful, even more beautiful. It's just one happiness after another one. It's such a marvelous path when you start to think about it. It's just absolutely, you know, it's kind of, quite in a very literal sense when you come far down the path. It literally is mind-blowing, quite literally. But anyway, this is what it's all about. So, and one of the things that you will perhaps notice already at this point is that there is a lot of similarity here between what you see here and also the Bhujangas. The Bhujangas have a similar kind of sequence, yeah? In the Bhujangas, it's termed slightly differently. It starts so with Sati, just like here. Then you have Piti in there, and then you move to Samadhi eventually in the Bhujangas. And this is exactly the same sequence you see here. It's just worded slightly differently. It gives you a different number of steps, yeah? You go to the what I call dependent liberation, which is also a sequence of steps where the mind ultimately is liberated. Very similar kind of sequence again. And it just shows the same thing from different angles. Anapanasati, dependent liberation, seven bhujanga, seven factors of awakening. I should translate these terms. All slightly different angles on basically the same process. Okay. So here, when you experience these feelings, you are still breathing, yeah? So the breath is still there, but what is happening is that the breath is becoming slightly more in the background and feelings are becoming more prominent here, yeah? So there is that is what is happening at this stage. Then we come to the third tetrad, and the third tetrad is equivalent to the mind contemplation, the citta nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. So this then fulfills the citta nupassana. This is all you have to do mind contemplation, the qualities of mind contemplation. And it goes as follows. It trains thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, stilling the mind. He breathes thus, trains thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So this is the mental contemplation, the mind, the various states of mind. And so we are moving from the feeling to experiencing the mind. What does that actually mean in practice? What does it mean to experience the mind? And what this means is that at this point, the entire body, yeah, the five senses, everything that has got nothing to do with the mind, all of that fades into the background. And when all of the physical phenomena fade into the background, what you are left with is basically the mind. Yeah, the senses are fading into the background, the body, it's still perhaps there, but it's kind of far away now, in the background somewhere. The mind comes into prominence. And this is always like, you know, if you want to know what something is, you have to allow all the things that it is not to disappear. You have to kind of isolate that phenomenon, yeah? And when it is isolated, then you can figure out what it is. So here you are isolating the mind from the other worldly and physical and sensory phenomena. And that is how the mind comes into focus. So what is this experience? And I think the most the probable answer to that is at this point is where we start to talk about the samadhi nimittas, yeah, the obhasa in the Pali text, the light arising. Because that light is precisely where the body and the senses fade away, and you're going into the mental world in a more powerful way. So this is the kind of the arising of the samadhi nimittas in the on the Buddhist path. The joy, the happiness, all the positive feelings are still there, now becoming, in fact, even stronger with the arising of a light, often very brilliant, beautiful light, very attractive. You're kind of drawn towards it very, very powerfully, but also a bit scary sometimes, depending on how bright it is, because you get this feeling of incredible power sometimes. So the nimitta can come in various degrees. And at the beginning here, this basically shows you here the process of how to work with the nimitta. This is what this process is about here. So first of all, you experience the mind, which I would say probably means that you're dealing with the light in the mind. Yeah, then to be able to take that further, you have to gladden this mind, gladden that nimitta. In other words, you are making it even more beautiful, even more happy, essentially. How do you do that? And basically, you just stay with it. Yeah, sometimes Ajahn Brahma says you focus on the center, you focus on the most beautiful part, you don't focus on the periphery. Yeah, and as you do that, there's a natural process which gladdens up the mind and the nimitta at this particular point. It becomes more happy. The idea here is to brighten it up so powerfully that eventually it takes you all the way into the jhanas. This is the point here. So you gladden it by staying with it. You still it. Yeah, there may still be some movement in the mind at this point, a little bit of movement back and forth, not entirely still. So you stay with it. Yeah, you just stay with it. No force. You don't do anything in particular. You just allow it to be. And by staying with it and focusing on the center, it starts to become still, becomes brighter and stiller. Yeah, the process at this point, already things are starting to get very otherworldly at this point and very marvelous. So at this point, you already kind of experience some of the greatest happinesses, maybe probably the greatest happiness that you've ever experienced before. Nothing like, you've never seen anything quite like this in your entire life, quite likely. And then comes the kind of the final, the great finale when it says you liberate the mind. And that is the kind of final point where the kind of mind kind of goes into a jhana experience. And you kind of, the nimitta, you kind of merge or fall into the nimitta or something like that. That liberation of the mind, what does it mean? What is it liberated from? And what it is liberated from is, first of all, the five senses. The whole world of kama loka. The universe, according to Buddhism, is divided into three kind of worlds. Kama loka being one, which is the world of sensory objects, the world of the five senses. Then you have the rupa loka, which is the form world, which is the world of the jhanas. And here you are moving from one world to the other one. Yeah, your mind is shifting from one world. You're leaving one world behind. And of course, as you do that, you can expect that to be a kind of a fairly clear boundary between these worlds. And that's what's happening. That's why you kind of, boom, something changes. And you leave something behind. Your mind is liberated from kama loka, from sensory experience, moving on to the rupa loka instead. So that's the liberation. Another liberation here is, of course, is the five hindrances. And if actually you're already liberated from the five hindrances already, because you can only enter a jhana state, you have to liberate from the hindrances first, and then you can enter the jhana. So they're already gone. But that is also part of this liberation, the full, final elimination of all the five hindrances. You also, in a sense, liberated from the will at this particular point. You have no more access to the will at this point. So this is what happens here. So this is the final thing you do, is to liberate the mind. In other words, you're just allowing the mind to enter jhana. That's really what it means to liberate here. You don't stand in the way. You don't have any fear or anything like that. You enter this astonishing state of jhanas. So, there you are. That is anapanasati. Yeah, and what a marvelous thing it is once you start to understand what is going on here. It's really kind of life-changing experiences that you have as you follow the very simple process of just following the breath. It's quite amazing what the little humble breath can do for you. It's quite remarkable. Then we come to the last tetrad of Anapanasati, and the last tetrad is equivalent to Dhamma Nupassana on the Satipatthana Sutta. Dhamma Nupassana, I was saying yesterday, is like the contemplation of principles, in particular understanding causality, what drives things, what kind of makes things appear, what makes them disappear, and all of this. So this is how it is explained in the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence, anicca. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. So what what is this all about? And what this is about, first of all, what exactly are you contemplating? What exactly is it that is impermanent? What is it that fades away? What is it that ceases? It doesn't state that outright. Yeah, it just says that you contemplate these things. How do you do that? And the most natural way to do that is that you have just been through a process of anapanasati, or watching the breath, and through that process of watching the breath, you have gathered so much data because you have clear awareness of what is going on. Yeah, you have seen things happening as you go through the process of mindfulness of breathing. First of all, you see the impermanence of things. You see the breath changing, and the breath changing, first of all, from being quite coarse and becoming more refined, eventually fading into the background, and eventually ceasing altogether. Yeah, so you see the anicca of the breath. It is not actually a stable thing. Then you see it's fading away, and eventually you see its cessation. Yeah, this is what this means. You go back to the process you have just been observing, and then you see these things in terms of that particular process. You see the same thing with the defilements of the mind. That's actually a very important part, is to see this process happening with the five hindrances. Yeah, you start out, your mind may not be 100% pure yet, and you see the purity of the mind increasing as you go through this process. Part of that is to see the joy arising. Yeah, you can see the inverse relationship between the joy and the defilements of the mind. The less defilements you have, the more joy you have. The more defilements you have, the less joy you have. The inverse relationship, yeah? And so this is, again, when you come out afterwards, you see this. You see the fading away, the impermanence, and eventually the cessation of these defilements of the mind. You see the body, same thing with the body. The body, first of all, it is present. Yeah, you can still feel it, especially initially when you haven't established mindfulness yet. But gradually it fades into the background until eventually it disappears altogether. Senses, five senses, exactly the same thing. Yeah, it gradually fades away, become less and less until eventually you're barely able to access the outer world anymore. The outer world gradually disappears until eventually in jhana it is completely gone. And this tells you one thing about why the deep samadhi experience, the jhana experience, are so profound and why they are so important. And the reason is because before you get to jhana, these things are still kind of there, slightly in the background. They haven't fully ceased yet, yeah? So you haven't seen their full impermanence yet. Once you enter a jhana state, they have gone, they have disappeared, you have no access to them. They have ceased 100%. And that is why that is such a powerful moment for insight, because here you actually understand impermanence in a very profound way. Not only do you understand impermanence, but because it has ceased completely, it is also obviously not part of your identity. Yeah, it can't be, because it's gone. Not part of your identity, it is non-self. And coming to a jhana, you think, wow, this is just the absolutely greatest bliss you have ever experienced. You know that the other stuff stands in the way of bliss, because it stands in the way of bliss, it is suffering as well. So this is why the jhana experiences are such incredibly pregnant with insight, because it is just so obvious what is going on at this particular point. You see the whole process going through, yeah? The whole thing kind of happening in this way here. So what you're seeing here is basically impermanence. And Nirodha, the cessation, is really the highest kind of impermanence. Anicca is when we just start off seeing things kind of changing a little bit. Viraga, fading away. And cessation is really anicca to the highest degree. So these are very closely related to each other here. Another thing that you see fading away in this process and disappearing is the will, yeah? You see how you become more and more still, more and more peaceful. The mind is doing less and less until eventually the will is completely gone. No more doing is possible, no more intention, no more choice. Yeah, and you realize at this point what a problem the will actually is. The less will you have, the more happy you are. When it's completely gone, that is where you find the most happiness. So it's strange how we identify with the will, isn't it? We identify with this, but actually, it's an aspect of suffering. And this becomes very, very clear when you come down to this last part here of mindfulness of breathing here. So this is how the whole thing works. And then ultimately, you then go through the deeper jhanas as well, first jhana, second jhana, liberation happening in deeper and deeper ways. And you start also to see the fading away, the very last thing, consciousness itself starts to fade away. Yeah? Actually, I should mention the other khandhas as well. You have, for example, feelings. Yeah, you see the change in feelings as you go through this. Certain feelings become less and less accessible. Pain kind of fades away until pain is completely gone in the first jhana. No more pain is possible. Certain feelings have ceased without remainder. Yeah, you're starting to get an insight into feelings. Perceptions, exactly the same thing. Perceptions are just your awareness of the world. Yeah, perceptions are changing all the way through towards more and more happiness, more and more stillness and these things. Other perceptions are no longer accessible. They have ceased. They have gone. Yeah, so you know that you know the impermanence of those things as well. And finally comes the impermanence of consciousness itself that you see, especially as you go through the deeper jhana experiences. So this is how the whole process works. And then the very last element of these four elements of insight is relinquishment. So what does that mean? And that means that when you see this thing very thoroughly, everything ceasing, and you see that it actually is all suffering, you're far better off without it. That is when craving can't exist anymore. You can't crave for what is suffering. Your mind literally turns away from all of these worldly phenomena. You have no interest there anymore. Why? Because you know it's dukkha. Happiness is to be found somewhere else. And relinquishment means that the craving actually starts to disappear. The craving fades away until it eventually is completely gone when you become an arahant. Yeah? When you become fully awakened at the very end of the path. So relinquishment is giving it up finally and completely, once and for all. Not just temporarily when it ceases in jhana, but the final relinquishment through insight itself. So this is what happens here. Yeah. So here you can see the combination, how this works. You get the feeling for samatha and vipassana, yeah, how it actually works here. So you have the whole process the first 12 steps is a process of samatha and vipassana. Everything calms down. Everything becomes more clear. And then when you come out of that process afterwards and you reflect back on it, that's when you have the deep insights. Yeah, and those deep insights are really just another way of having even more profound samatha and vipassana. When the insight becomes very deep, you feel even more peaceful. Yeah, when the peacefulness is profound, you can have more insight. It always goes together like that, all the way through. Okay, so that is the Anapanasati Sutta. And the Buddha finishes off by saying, that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. So it's a beautiful sutta, it kind of gives you a very nice overview of what is actually going on. It's quite easy to understand almost the entire path just by contemplating and reflecting on this sutta. And what a wonderful thing it is that a simple thing, like all you have to do in your life, is watch the breath. You watch the breath with the right attitude, and all of these things happen as a consequence. Okay, then having gone through the process of satipatthana, including all the way up to the jhanas, then of course we come to the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right stillness. And we have already talked about that a little bit, but this is the standard definition of right stillness on the path. It's the definition of the four jhanas themselves. This is how it works. So, through the process of mindfulness of breathing, what we have done is eliminate the last defilements. We have stilled the mind, until it is ready to enter the jhanas. And now, this is the description, according to the suttas, of the four jhanas. What is right stillness? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, one dwells and enters in the first jhana, which is accompanied by initial and sustained application of the mind, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. So that is the first jhana. Yeah, this is a standard formula in the suttas. And let me just give a very brief commentary on this. I don't think we have to talk too much about this. Just very brief. Secluded from sensual pleasures means actually secluded from the five senses. Yeah, because sensual, the word kama in the suttas actually refers to the five senses when it's used in the plural. And here it is used in the plural. Secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome qualities, this is the five hindrances, that is when you enter the first jhana, which is accompanied by vitakka, vichara. And this is, this I mentioned yesterday, the very last movement of the mind, that kind of goes to the object and then kind of gradually, slightly holds on to it. It has a very fine movement of the mind. It's involuntary. The mind just does this by itself. You're just kind of observing this going on. And here, the particular type of happiness you have here is the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. It's a very specific type of happiness. It's a very profound happiness. Yeah, you have already, as you have seen already through the Anapanasati Sutta, already experienced so much happiness on the path already, so much piti, so much sukha, so much of these positive emotions. But now you enter an entirely, not entirely, but a kind of continuation of that, an even more profound experience of sukha and piti. Yeah, this is specifically called the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, because for the first time in your life you are entirely secluded from these things, the body, the senses, and all of this. So that is a very profound degree of happiness at this point, but it is not the end. Then we go to even more profound things. With the subsiding of initial and sustained application of the mind, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without initial and sustained application of the mind, and has rapture and happiness born of stillness. Yeah, so here is when you abandon the final movement of the mind. The mind becomes utterly still, completely fixed like that, no movement anymore in your perception or feelings. Everything is fixed at this particular point. And this is called confidence. It's confidence because the mind is confident in the object. The reason why in the first jhana there is a little bit of movement is there isn't that full confidence yet. When the mind moves onto it fully and stays with it, that's called confidence here. Unification of mind means, it just means no movement. The mind has completely become one thing. Yeah, one object, hour after hour after hour, going on for very, very long periods of time. And this particular happiness is a different type of happiness again. It's called the rapture and happiness born of stillness. Even more profound. They all sound almost the same. Yeah, rapture and happiness and these things. But the point is, you're actually going deeper and deeper and deeper with each one of these. Each one, you're going into kind of a more otherworldly state. And here we really are talking about otherworldly stuff. It is kind of really out. It's literally out of this world because it is out of the world of the five senses. So then you go to the next one. Still haven't come to the end. Yeah, you kind of experienced the most happiness you ever dreamt of was possible. Still haven't come to the end. With the fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous and mindful and clearly comprehending. He experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. Yeah, so if you, it's kind of understated. Yeah, okay, you come to the third jhana, then you are one who dwells happily. Before that, yeah, you're kind of happy, yeah, but not really there yet. Understated, yeah, it's kind of nice. And this is one of the ways of remembering that when you read the suttas, that they tend to be understated. When the Buddha says you're happy, he means really, really happy. So this is the highest happiness that you can experience in samsaric existence. You can go beyond this, but when you go beyond this, you're no longer actually experiencing happiness. When you go beyond this, what you're experiencing is equanimity. And equanimity is actually better than happiness. Yeah? Equanimity is more happy than happiness. Get it? Yeah. So the point is that happy feeling has certain limitations to it. And when you go beyond the happy feelings, it's actually preferable. It's a preferable state. And that's why it is more happy than happiness. But if you want to experience happiness, this is the utmost that is possible in samsaric existence, yeah? The third jhana. You can't go beyond this. And so here, at this point, the rapture is completely faded away. And what exactly that means, you have to be there to know what these things mean. Yeah, there's a more refined type of happiness that remains. And mindful and clearly comprehending, you're kind of reaching the pinnacle of these qualities. Yeah, you have been mindful and clearly comprehending for a long time already, but now it reaches kind of the highest potential. And that is why when you come out of these states, why as you go up the jhanas, they become more and more powerful to enable insight afterwards, because the mind is more powerful. The mindfulness always increasing, the clear comprehension always increasing, yeah? So it gives you more and more ability, more and more stability to actually have insight afterwards. You enter, and then you enter the experience happiness, and you enter the third jhana as a consequence. And then we come to the fourth jhana. And this is kind of where things get really weird, because with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right stillness. Yeah, so here you have abandoned all pleasure and pain, because these are two sides of the same coin, pleasure and pain. So if you to go fully beyond pain as well as pleasure, you have to abandon the pleasure, because of the they often go together. So here you go beyond all happiness. Yeah, pleasure and pain is gone, joy and displeasure is gone, and you have neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Yeah? And this is pretty much the best you can get. There's nothing beyond this. This is kind of going to the very, very, very end of the Buddhist path. And the reason why, again, this kind of state is so powerful is because this is the first time in your life you understand that happy feeling actually is not really worth it. If equanimity is better than happy feelings, suddenly for the first time you actually realize that all happy feeling is to be given up. Yeah, because there's something better, something preferable to happy feeling here. All that is left is equanimity, neither pain nor pleasure. And that is why it is at this point having insight is it's so easy. And this is why the path really ends here, because now you have seen that almost anything you ever wanted in your life, you see, actually, it wasn't worth having. All the pleasure, all the happiness, all of that is kind of, you can discard it all. You've let go of it. And things are actually better as a consequence. Yeah, it's very hard to understand this. It's very difficult to get this, because you have just experienced some of the greatest happiness that is possible for human beings to experience. And you can't believe that so much happiness is possible. And then you go further, you abandon it, and it's even better. It's kind of, this really is, these experiences really are mind-blowing in almost a literal sense, because this is how you actually give up all mentality at the end of the practice. So at this point, what happens next? Well, at this point, you know, you don't really have to do very much. You already have right view, and that right view conjoined with the power of these jhana experiences means that the insights will just happen. You come out of this and, you know, bang, things just happen automatically. And that's why the path kind of ends at this particular point. And that's when all the most marvelous things on the path happens as a consequence. So let us have a quick look at these marvelous things that happen as a consequence. And now we're coming to the very kind of final thing here. We're coming back to the delightful discourse. Yeah, you can see how this goes in circle. I started off with a delightful discourse on the very first day, and the very last day coming back to the same discourse, but now a little bit further down in the same one. So this is what the Buddha has to say. He's speaking to Venerable Chunda. It may be, Chunda, that wanderers of other sects might say, the ascetics who follow the Sakyan are devoted to a life of pleasure. If so, they should be asked, what kind of life of devotion to pleasure, friend? For such a life can take many forms. There are, Chunda, four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, common, worldly, ignoble, and not conducive to welfare, that do not lead to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to awakening, and to nirvana. Okay, to nirvana. What are they? Firstly, a foolish person takes pleasure and delight in killing living beings. Secondly, someone takes pleasure and delight in taking what is not given. Thirdly, someone takes pleasure and delight in telling lies. Fourthly, someone gives himself up to the indulgence in and enjoyment of the pleasures of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life, devoted to pleasure, which are low, common, not leading to disenchantment, not leading to enlightenment, not leading to extinguishment, which is nirvana here. So here, the Buddha has kind of expanded it to four kinds of pleasure, but obviously the one that really matters here is the last one, the enjoyment in the five senses. That's the one that is hard to give up. The other ones are fairly obvious. And it may be that those other sects might say, are the followers of the Sakyan given to these four forms of pleasure seeking? And they should be told no, for they would not be speaking correctly about you. They would be slandering you with false and untrue statements. The Archanda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to awakening, to extinguishment. What are they? Firstly, a monk detached from the sense desire and the sensory objects of the world, detached from all unwholesome mental qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. Yeah, and then we have the same sequence we've just seen before. Enters and remains in the first jhana, then the second jhana, then the third jhana, and then eventually the fourth jhana. And then the Buddha says in the next paragraph, these are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to repulsion, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to awakening, to extinguishment. So if wanderers from other sects should say that the followers of the Sakyans are addicted, it's a very strong word, addicted or following these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told yes, for they will be speaking correctly about you. They would not be slandering you with false or untrue statements. That is a very powerful statement, the idea that we should seek these kind of pleasures. These are the pleasures that are conducive to all the positive things in the world. Yeah? So we should actually be pursuing the happiness of the mind, the pitisukha, the jhanas, and all of these kind of things. He translates it here as addicted to. Maybe that is slightly on the strong side, but you kind of get this. In other words, you are really devoted to these things. Yeah, you understand this is what life is all about. Everything else is really irrelevant. This is where you hang out. You're always seeking to find ways, time, to be able to be secluded, go back to your cave and just enjoy this kind of happiness. This is kind of the thing. Yeah? So someone who is really into the jhanas, you will see them trying to disappear as quickly as they possibly can. Yeah, if you see them kind of looking at the clock, yeah, it means that they want to go back to the cave and they kind of want to chill. That's really what it means. Then such wanderers might ask, well then, those who are given to these four forms of pleasure seeking, how many fruits, how many benefits can they expect? And you should reply, they can expect four fruits and four benefits. What are they? Yeah, this is why you practice jhanas. The first is when a monk or a nun or a lay follower or any lay follower, by the destruction of the three fetters, has become a stream winner, no more subject to rebirth in the lower worlds, firmly established, destined to full awakening. This is the first fruit of practicing the four jhanas. The second is when a person, a monk, a nun, or a lay disciple, by the complete destruction of the three fetters and the reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion, of desire, ill will, and confusion, has become a once returner, and having returned once more to this world, would put an end to suffering. Yeah, these are each of the four stages of awakening, going up, up, up. How do you do it? Simply by practicing the four jhanas. The third is when the monk, nun, or the lay disciple, by the complete destruction of the five lower fetters, has been spontaneously reborn and there will reach extinguishment without returning from that world. Yeah, so the five lower fetters, they are the three that we saw before. Yeah, the not Sakkaya Ditti, the which the stream winner already overcomes. In other words, the sense of the view of a self, yeah, and then the vichikicca, the doubt, and then the overcoming of the attachment to precepts and conduct. And now also, this person also destroys ill will and all sensual desire. And that is why you are spontaneously reborn, and you get reborn in the Brahmaloka as a consequence. This is the Anagami, it's called in Pali, coming very, very close. And once returner is usually the last stage where you can be usually considered a lay disciple. After this, final one is really only for that point you become a monastic. So the fourth one, this is when you become an arahant. But it's destruction of the corruptions. These are the asavas, the root defilements of the mind. In this very life, by his own knowledge and realization, attains to arahantship, to deliverance of the heart and the deliverance of wisdom. Such are the four fruits and the four benefits that are given to these four forms, given to those who practice these forms of pleasure-seeking can expect. So the last one, the deliverance of heart and the deliverance through wisdom. Deliverance of the heart is the liberation from all defilements. Yeah, your mind is freed from these obstructions, these slave drivers that always drive you around, never give you any peace, and never give you any true happiness. And the deliverance through wisdom is the deliverance through insight, the seeing of not understanding where dukkha is really found, the understanding that there's nothing in this world worth holding on to. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesayaha. Nothing, no phenomena is worth attaching to. It's that kind of root statement, one of those beautiful little summaries of the Buddhist teaching. There's nothing in the entire world worthy of holding on to. And that is when you become an arahant, yeah? Finally liberated from everything. And this is how you do it. How do you do it? By enjoying yourself. Yeah. It's good news, isn't it? It's absolutely wonderful there. So that is the Buddhist path, from the beginning to the end, the Noble Eightfold Path. This is just one particular way of thinking about the Noble Eightfold Path. Not maybe one particular way, but one particular emphasis that I have given. Really, when you start reading the suttas, you start to see all the different ways in which you can bring in to this Noble Eightfold Path. So please do that study for yourself. When you start reading the suttas, what you find out is that there's so much in there, and some of the things will speak to you much more powerfully than other things, and we are all slightly different. So things will speak to you in a different way than they speak to everyone else. So read them sometimes for yourself. Get inspired on some of these passages that I have not even mentioned here. Yeah, and then you will, after a while, you become using the suttas for your benefit and for your happiness. So, just to summarize, this is the path of purification. It is all about purifying ourselves. And the more purified you are, the more close you are to the four jhanas. And the full purity is really the attainment of these four jhanas. That's when you have achieved full purity. And because the mind is fully purified, that is when insight happens. So for this reason, because it is a path of purity, the most important thing in your life is just to remember very simple things like kindness. If you can remember that single word kindness in your ordinary life, in your ordinary activities, you're going to go a really long way on this path. Because kindness, it summarizes all the ideas of sila, yeah, of avoiding the bad things and doing the good things. Kindness also summarizes the idea that we should have the right mental attitude of metta and compassion and these things. So it summarizes all of these things very beautifully. So if you can remember that one word in your life, what a wonderful thing that is. You're going to go a really, really long way if you do that. But of course, sometimes we can't remember that one word, yeah? It's impossible because we get so busy, so many things happen. We even forget that because we lose our mindfulness and our ability to see what we should be doing in the present. So to enable you to have that commitment and perseverance to the simple idea of kindness, it is so important to come back to these teachings again and again to inspire you, to uplift you, to drive you in the right direction so you can keep on purifying yourself and keep on doing the right thing. And this is why, this is the root thing on the Buddhist path, the most fundamental thing, the thing which keeps that rain raining on the top of the mountain. Remember that simile I spoke about before, the rain on the top of the mountain, yeah? And as it rains, it starts to form into little streams. The streams go into the lakes, the small lakes into the large lakes into the rivers into the ocean, and the ocean is Nibbana itself. And the rain on the top of the mountain is keeping on, working on the right view, reading the suttas, remembering the Dhamma at all whenever you feel a little bit uninspired or you need like a shot of Dhamma, yeah? This is a good kind of addiction. It kind of gives you an idea of addiction when you kind of inject a bit of Dhamma into your mental life, and then you keep going in this way here. So keep some of these basic things in mind. Sometimes it is too much. You can't really remember all of this. It doesn't matter. It is there at the back of your mind, and it will come out when you really require it. So that is that's it. So very good. So I just like to say that again, just to kind of reinforce what people saying yesterday, but thanking everyone. It's wonderful that everybody has been working so well together, especially the people who are running the retreat center and everyone else. And thank you all for coming and for making it a successful retreat. It really depends on everyone that it becomes successful, yeah? If everyone does the right thing, and then usually it kind of happens by itself. So thank you very much, and thank you very much for Venerable Akaliko for also supporting me, always being there, and for the nuns to coming. It creates a nice atmosphere when all the four parisas, yeah, all the four assemblies come together. It's actually very nice, and the whole Buddhist community is here. What a wonderful thing that is. And lastly, it was suggested that we should have a group picture. So I think Bianca had said 9:30, so 9:30 today. If it is convenient, we'll do it outside. It may be a bit wet. If not outside, we'll do it in here. It is voluntary. If you really don't want to come, you don't have to come. Yeah, I don't like compulsory things myself. So it's really, really up to you. But if you want to come back here in about 10, 13 minutes exactly, 12 minutes, then we will do it here in 30 minutes. Okay. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha one last time.
Sāvaka-saṅgho, saṅghaṁ-dhāṁ.